Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has lashed out at the muted global response to the killing of dozens of Palestinians in protests this week along the Israel-Gaza border.
İşte Birleşmiş Milletler bütün bu olaylar karşısında...
Mr. Erdogan said the UN has ended. It has become exhausted and collapsed. He spoke of the silence that greeted what he called Israeli bullying. Turkey expelled the Israeli ambassador and the consul general. It also recalled its ambassador to Tel Aviv. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Emmanuel Menachon said Israel responded by reprimanding a Turkish diplomat.
We have summoned today the deputy ambassador of Turkey to the Israeli Foreign Ministry in order to express our concern and our dismay at a gross violation of the diplomatic ethics and the relations between countries. This morning, the ambassador of Israel was publicly humiliated in the airport of Istanbul. He was subject to a security check which was absolutely unnecessary.
The violent protests of Monday and Tuesday eased Wednesday. Meanwhile, Hamas, which rules Gaza, acknowledged all but a dozen of the 62 killed were members of the Islamist group. Thousands of doses of an experimental Ebola vaccine have arrived in Democratic Republic of Congo to combat an outbreak of the deadly virus, which claimed more than 20 lives in the northwest. Anna Maria Hennal Restrepo is a World Health Organization team leader.
We have 4,000 doses that are arriving in Kinshasa safely. These 4,000 that are here in these boxes are going to be replenishment doses. We intend to send them soon this week to complete the first installment of vaccines.
More than 400 people in DRC are suspected of having had contact with Ebola. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump has suggested the path forward to a much-anticipated meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un next month in Singapore is unclear.
We haven't seen anything. We haven't heard anything. We will see what happens.
Mr. Trump's brief remarks at the White House came after North Korea suggested the meeting could be in jeopardy over joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises and demands over its denuclearization. China Wednesday said the U.S.-North Korean talks should go ahead. The North abruptly canceled a high-level talk scheduled Wednesday with the South. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to meet President Trump at the White House next Tuesday. The U.N. Special Envoy to Syria, Staffan de Mistura, Wednesday told the U.N. Security Council a government assault on rebel-held Idlib province would be far more destructive than the prolonged battle to recapture the eastern Ghouta enclave near Damascus.
We fear that any escalation or substantial escalation in Idlib or in Daraa or in the northeast may also incur risks not only to Syrian civilians but also to international peace and security. Because, as you know, many of these areas contain external and international forces.
Idlib is home to more than 2 million people, many of them having fled conflict elsewhere in the country and have no other place to go. The U.S. joined Gulf states in imposing additional sanctions on the Lebanese Shia movement Hezbollah's leadership, including Syed Hassan Nasrallah and Naim Qassem. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said the sanctioning nations reject what he called the false distinction between the so-called political wing and the group's terrorist plotting. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega opened talks Wednesday with members of the opposition trying to quell a month of anti-government unrest that's left more than 50 dead. Students were joined by members of the business community and unions at a session held in the capital of Managua. Mr. Ortega was interrupted with shouts of murderer and calls for an end to repression. Tens of thousands took to the streets in April over Social Security reforms, protests that turned violent. Rights groups in Gambia have implicated former President Yahya Jammeh of the deaths of more than 50 West African migrants in 2005 and are seeking his extradition and prosecution. Following interviews with former Gambian officials, the groups allege the migrants were mistaken for mercenaries trying to overthrow Jammeh, detained and executed by a paramilitary unit. On Wall Street, stocks eked out a modest gain Wednesday with the benchmark Dow Jones gaining 62 points to 24,768. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 17th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundians are voting today in a referendum that some say will keep President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034.
Despite all the intimidation, threats and everything, people will decide their own destiny, because this is not the first time there is a big challenge.
Agathon Raza is an opposition leader and deputy speaker of parliament. $6 million for agricultural projects in three East African countries. Dakar University students protest the police killing of their own. And Cameroon's government finalizes plans for this Sunday's celebration of the country's National Day.
It is not Southern Cameroon's National Day. It is not Ambazonian National Day. It is a national day for celebration for the Republic of Cameroon, because what they are celebrating is the conquering of Southern Cameroon.
Christmas Ibini is an elder supporter of Cameroon's self-proclaimed Ambazonian secessionist movement. A UN official criticized the continuing kidnapping of aid workers in South Sudan, and West Africa taps solar energy potential. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundians are voting today, Thursday, in a constitutional amendment referendum that some say, if passed, will keep President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034. President Nkurunziza has ruled Burundi since the end of the country's civil war in 2005. Nkurunziza won a third term in a violent election in 2015. The opposition said then that the election was a violation of the country's constitution. Moses Habyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
It was a grim situation here in Cibitoki on the eve of the country's historical day. To amend the 2005 constitution that will see the presidential term extended from 5 to 7 years, the Burundi government conducted a mass funeral for the 26 people killed in Cibitoki province, located in northwestern part of the country. Joseph Iteriteka is the governor of Cibitoki. He says that terrorist groups came from neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, and that all neighboring countries should come together in order to stop that group. Today, Burundians are at the polling station to vote for or against the constitution amendment. There is visibly beefed up security in the country's capital since last night. Burundi's opposition leader and deputy speaker of the parliament, Agathon Rwasa, said that he is optimistic that Burundians will reject the bill.
Despite all the intimidation, threats and everything, people will decide of their own destiny, because this is not the first time there is a big challenge. In 1961, 1993, and even 2005, and even today.
Among the articles that are most likely to be amended other than the presidential term limit is Article 49 of the current constitution, that indicates that a Burundian can be extradited abroad if he is prosecuted by an international criminal court for genocide crimes, war crimes or other crimes against humanity. If amended, no Burundian can be extradited. Jean-Claude Bigirimana is a citizen in Bujumbura and talks about his feeling about the referendum.
I think good about it. It's not a problem for citizens like me. And I'm happy about these referendums because the government is trying to put power in the citizen. We are the one to decide. So I don't have any problem with it, and I am ready to go and vote. We are ready to do that.
The international community criticized the Burundi government's move to conduct a referendum at a time when the regional mediated dialogue is yet to come to an end. However, Burundi government and ruling supporters believe that the referendum will guarantee peace and stability in the country. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
East African member countries have secured $6 million to help farmers in three East African countries, Uganda, Kenya, and Rwanda. Maganda Julius Wandera, Uganda's Minister for East African Affairs, says the funds will be used to increase both the quantity and the quality of farmers' produce. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakarich has the story from Kampala.
The funds were secured by Kilimo Trust, an East African-based organization that promotes agro-business development from Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, or AGRA, and the three partner states. Minister Wandela says the funds will help farmers increase yield and eradicate perennial famine in the region.
So while we are saying Uganda has a surplus production, do we reach the requirement in quality? And those also will be addressed in this whole program. So we have targets in maize, we have targets in beans, we have targets where we are looking at potatoes. These are also areas, and if you want to cure hunger in your family, you go for potatoes, because it is something that you can run for a longer period of time before you even conclude the whole garden.
At least 300,000 farmers, mainly women and youth, will be provided with financial assistance and educated on modern farming methods. Wandela says increased yields will also help boost regional trade.
The trade within Uganda, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, within the region is at 11%. But we are even trading in a subsistence kind of production. It's not established or finished or value-added products, which are really identifiable. You find that the value-added products is very minimal. Now, in this kind of program also has an element where we are supposed even to do value addition. We are supposed to do commercial, and where they are supposed to earmark the market, the demands of the market within the region.
Dr. Birungi Korotaro is the head of Kilimo Trust in Uganda. She says they expect at least 120,000 metric tons of agricultural products valued at over $60 million to be traded in across the region.
We'll build their capacity in terms of supporting them to understand how best they can use fertilizers, improved seed, so that they can produce higher yields. And also we will give them the guaranteed market so that what they produce is actually sold to a particular buyer, either a processor, a trader, or a retailer, either in national markets or in regional markets.
The project will be for a duration of 5 years in Uganda and 3 years in Rwanda and Kenya. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Preparations are in their final stages for this Sunday's May 20th Cameroon 46th National Day celebration. It is the day in 1972 when Cameroonians voted for a unitary state against the then federal system. The theme of this year's celebration is Cameroonian citizens, let us remain united in diversity and preserve social peace for a stable, indivisible and prosperous Cameroon. The day comes amid a nearly two-year-long uprising in the country's English-speaking southwestern northwestern regions against what the citizens there called their marginalization by the predominantly French-speaking government of Cameroon. Christmas Ibini is an elder supporter of the self-proclaimed Abanzonian secessionist movement of Cameroon. He says the 20th May celebration has no significance to southern Cameroonians because it signifies the enslavement of the people of South Cameroon.
Well, I am glad, James, you said Cameroon National Day. It is not Southern Cameroon's National Day. It is not Ambazonian National Day. It is a national day for celebration for the Republic of Cameroon, because what they are celebrating and taking Southern Cameroonians as their slaves, that 20th May has no significance to Southern Cameroonians. People in our midst were celebrating it in the past by armed force from La République du Cameroun. This time around, our people have come to understand their history and the significance to them of that day. That is the day that the French and the La République du Cameroun went away from the terms of union between La République du Cameroun and Southern Cameroon. Article 47 of that contract under the 1961 Constitution stated very clearly that no action should be taken to change the structure and the agreement of the union between Southern Cameroons and La République du Cameroun from a federal structure to anything else. So that is a day of celebration for the conquerors and the abusers of La République du Cameroun, and we would not celebrate it.
The theme of Sunday's celebration is Cameroonian citizens, let us remain united in diversity and preserve social peace for a stable, indivisible, and prosperous Cameroon. The government is reaching out.
Mr. James, my brother, you are a man of news, and I know that you know history. you know well affairs very well, and you talk to me about preaching peace. How do you preach peace to a people when you chase them from their homes into the forest, into refugee camps? How do you preach peace when you go to towns and villages and set them ablaze, roasting elderly people and children inside the homes? How do you preach peace by violating people's rights constantly? How do you seek unity by waterboarding innocent citizens? Tell me, is that preaching peace? Their actions are there for the world to see.
I know you've been agitating for some time, but one of the issues, one or two of the issues, was that the issue about education in the Southern Cameroon and the use of French in the schools, and also the legal system. President Paul Biya, just as a way of trying to address these issues, ordered the recruitment of at least about 1,000 young bilingual science and technical teachers. That's one thing, again, to say maybe the government realizes and is trying to correct the mistake of the past.
Well, they can do that for themselves. What we know and what we see and what we have felt, their action from the time when the lawyers and teachers were begging them to dialogue, to change a few things, what did they do? They arrested them and put them in jail. Most of those guys whom they arrested at that time were people who were advocating for federalism. There were those who were begging them for unity. There were those who were begging them for peace. There were those who were begging them to cohabit with Southern Cameroonians as their own brothers, respecting their rights and everything. What did they do? They arrested them and put them in jail. Even their own Supreme Court judge, who was asking for regional decentralization, which does not meet, is not even in the spirit of the Southern Cameroon's quest, was arrested and locked up for 8 months. Is that what you call solving a problem? They may write on paper that, oh, they are recruiting teachers. This is not the first time they started recruiting teachers. The legal system is still the same. We have civilians who are in jail, and they keep taking them every time to military courts. These are civilians who are not armed. And you say that's solving the problem? No, sir. They don't want to solve the problem. They will have declared war against us. They want to treat us as slaves in our own land. And that is unacceptable. We would resist that to the last man standing.
Christmas Ibini is an elder supporter of the self-proclaimed Ambazonian Secessionist Movement of Cameroon. You are speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Thursday, May 17th. Daybreak Africa time is now 18 minutes past the hour. Students burned cars and threw rocks this week at the University of Dakar in response to the police killing of a student during the protest at another Senegalese university. Earlier this week, students in St. Louis were protesting what they said was the government's inaction in paying their scholarships when police opened fire and killed student Falou Sen. The protest marked a continuation of year-long marches and demands by students. The students say the government is not living up to its responsibilities. Their leader, Massou Sen, spoke to Ricky Stryak about what action they want the government to take in order to stop the protests.
All children are angry about what will happen yesterday. The reason why they are just going on street, going on struggle, just to denounce what is happening, just to denounce the situation of students, because we know that the authority don't respect the students. We tire out every year, each government come and kill a student. We have in the case of the students, and yesterday we have in the case of Falusen.
Students have been protesting for a while now about the conditions of the university. So can you tell me a little bit more about this? This isn't just a reaction to this one event, I think. This is kind of on top of all of the frustrations you guys have been feeling. Is that correct?
If you say that at the end of the month, we will pay you your scholarship, they will never do it at time. And we can say here also the situation of the university is more than complicated, or is becoming more and more complicated each year.
The problem is not just the scholarships, though, correct? The problem is overcrowding. The problem is a lack of supplies. Is that correct?
Really, we're not in good condition. We're all in bad condition. It's the same in the social campus, but also it is the same in the pedagogical campus. You know, when we go to study there in the pedagogy campus,
we have the same problem. The problem becomes more and more complicated. The problem becomes more and more the same thing.
Can you tell me a little bit about your group, Carbon 14, Carbon 14? When were you guys started and why?
Just the Carbon 14 movement is a movement in which you will find students. It is about the fight of Sheikh Anta Diop. The children who love Sheikh Anta Diop, because we know that Sheikh Anta Diop, even if it is a, say, it is a Senegal, he is a Senegalese, but right now the Senegalese people don't know who is Sheikh Anta Diop. And as our students, we have said that it is one of our struggles must be how we can do to make children or to make Senegalese people to know who is Sheikh Anta Diop. The reason why me as an artist, I'm preparing just the an album. And the album is an album which will render homage to Sheikh Anta Diop. Why? It's just to do a participation about just to put people to go far, just to try to know who is Sheikh Anta Diop, because they don't know Sheikh Anta Diop.
That was Masuo Sen, president of the student activist group Carbon 14. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. A top UN official visiting South Sudan says he is deeply disappointed by continuing kidnappings and abductions of aid workers by South Sudan's warring parties, as well as the decreasing impediment to humanitarian assistance. Dino Silva Arilio reports from Juba.
Mark Lowcock, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator, says more than 10 aid workers have been abducted in South Sudan in the past 2 months.
In the last 2 months alone, 4 aid workers have been killed, and that takes the total killed since the conflict began to more than 100. Most of them are the citizens of South Sudan. Crimes are being committed against aid workers with apparent impunity. There needs to be accountability. And the government, because it is the government, and this is a responsibility of governments everywhere, have the prime responsibility for that.
Lowcock says both the government and the armed opposition have done too little to end the violence and prevent their forces from obstructing aid workers from reaching the people in need of assistance.
But not only has the violence increased, but humanitarian agencies are increasingly impeded from saving lives by the restrictions of the operating environment. And what we need is rapid, safe, unhindered access to all people in need. When I discussed these issues with the government here in Juba yesterday, they assured me that they want humanitarian agencies to have unimpeded access to everyone who needs help, wherever they are. But unfortunately, that is not the situation that prevails at the moment. The aid agencies are subject to harassment, extortion, looting, kidnappings, killings, predatory fees and levies, and other blockages all over the country.
Lowcock visited a UN Protection of Civilians site in Yei town of Yei River State today to see firsthand how the conflict is affecting civilians, especially women and children. He says all the IDPs he met told him they want South Sudan's leaders to immediately stop the fighting.
The people we've met both yesterday here in Juba and today in both Yei town, which is under the government's control, and Mundu, which is under the opposition control, when you ask them what they want, the first thing they say, whoever they are, is the same. They want peace. So ending the violence is the first and single most important thing that's needed to alleviate the human suffering in this country.
Lowcock welcomes the recent announcement by the United States government to review their assistance programs to South Sudan to ensure that the support does not indirectly fuel the conflict. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Workers in South Africa will soon begin construction of a new 100-megawatt solar power plant near the town of Pofadder. In Morocco, expansion of a giant solar plant will soon increase its capacity to 580 megawatts. Solar energy has been slower to arrive in West Africa, but as Brian Postemas reports for VOA from Bamako, growth is underway.
Je voudrais annoncer le lancement du plan solaire dénommé Yelen, qui signifie lumière.
West Africa's largest power station was officially opened in November 2017. It's at Zaktuli, on the outskirts of Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou. It cost $55 million to build. The money came from France and the European Union. Zaktuli now delivers 30 megawatts to the national power grid.
On produit au fil du soleil. Donc, comme vous disiez avant, il y a pas de stockage.
Before Zaktuli, this was West Africa's largest, at Bohol in Senegal. It opened in 2016, cost $30 million to build, but the money story here is different. Charlotte Aubin, founder and director of Greenwish, a renewable energy company, was closely involved. She helped create the first independent power producer, or IPP, with money from Senegalese investors and an international fund backed by three European governments.
The first project we did was in Senegal, and it was a milestone for the continent as well as Greenwich, because it was the first solar IPP that came out of the ground in sub-Saharan Africa, and it's now providing electricity to 160,000 people at a 40% discount to the cost of the grid at the time.
40% less? How's that possible? Moussa Koulibaly, who runs Aircom, one of Mali's oldest solar power companies, explains. It's the expansion of the technology, Koulibaly told VOA. The more people want a product, the cheaper it gets. Led by investment from the United States and China, the industry has been rapidly scaling up. Production costs have come down as a result. Koulibaly says he has seen the price of a solar panel reduced by more than 500% in Mali in only 12 years. He says today a solar panel will cost you 50,000 CFA francs. That's about $90. Something else has changed too in the region, the law. Until recently, independent power producers like Aircom and the Greenwish project could not exist. The law simply prohibited it. Senegal lifted the ban on non-state power production in 1998. Mali did it in 2000, while Burkina Faso legalized IPPs only last year. Senegal now has four solar power stations. Burkina Faso is building two more. South Africa and Morocco have dozens each. And the list is getting longer. Kenya, Ethiopia, Mozambique, Ghana, Mauritania. At nighttime, an estimated 600 million Africans still use candles and kerosene lamps to light their homes. Many live in the continent's vast rural zones. How do you get all those millions connected? Charlotte Aubin has an idea that would use existing structures. Telephone towers.
There is about 240,000 towers that are off-grid or bad grid that could benefit from clean tech solution, but we are also looking at doing more for population.
Interest in off-grid solar is booming in West Africa. Companies like Aircom in Mali build small local grids tailor-made for the communities they serve. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Bamako.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Burundians are voting today, Thursday, in a constitutional amendment referendum that some say, if passed, will keep President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034. Nkurunziza has ruled Burundi since the end of the country's civil war in 2005. And that's it for this Thursday, May 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important after-news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.